This is WGRE 91.5 FM, Greencastle, Indiana.
Good evening and welcome to Music for Life, Music from DePaul. This week we focus on our upcoming opera, Albert Herring, including a conversation with visiting professor and director Joachim Schomburger. We talk about an innovative way some DePaul students have chosen to share their music with prison inmates. We visit with 1980 graduate Ian Davidson as he stops by campus in the midst of a tour. And we welcome back to campus American hero and DePaul alum Vernon Jordan as he discusses narrating New Morning of the World as part of Music of the 21st Century. There are lots of exciting things happening in the School of Music, and we're glad you could join us for Music for Life. This week, we're talking about our upcoming opera, Albert Herring, and joining me is our conductor, Professor Orsina Smith. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much.
Or I should say, welcome back as a frequent visitor to our
show.
You have a lot going on. You just wrapped up Music of the 21st Century with Joe Schwantner, and we'll get to hear a little bit of that fantastic finale as our show wraps up this week. But now you're out of the frying pan and into the fire, because now you're into the opera. How are things going?
Well, the students are very, very impressive. The staging of our visiting guest professor, Joachim Schomburger of opera, the students really impressed Joachim, who comes from, you know, a European traditional environment.
Yeah, very famous name. We're very fortunate to have him here.
And how well that they worked. And by the end of winter term, everything was musically prepared and completely staged. That was the goal. So we set the piece aside, and now we're returning to it here just a couple of weeks to touch it up and bring some intensity to it as well. The opera storyline is based on a little play by Guy de Maupassant, a French author in about 1887. He wrote this thing called Le Rosier de Madame Husson, which is a story about a little village, Guisot, in Paris that has an annual festival for a rose queen. But the problem is they can't find any girls that are virtuous enough.
Right.
So they take the village idiot, a young boy, and they turn him into the Rose King. Well, Britain does the same thing. And there is this woman who's very puffed up about how she thinks life should be in their community. And they have a May Queen festival. But the storyline translates very well.
Yeah, the funny thing is they can't find a woman that is virtuous enough to be the May Queen, so they decide they'll pick a man to be the May Queen, and it's the village idiot, and unfortunately someone spikes the punch, and he turns out to be a drunkard at the wrong moment.
Right, and this story actually it parallels the line in the Maupassant story, where in that case the village idiot, although in this case Albert Herring is not the village idiot, he's just kind of a squashed down young man who's works in the grocery that his mother owns
and lives his life under her thumb
and under the floor. Actually, we have him in the cellar coming up every once in a while. And basically what happens after he's given this honor of being the May King and the award of 25 quid, he goes and blows some of the money with alcohol and loose women.
Right, which kind of puts a fork in the idea that we found the May King.
Right, and so of course the problem is that after the big ceremony of celebrating his kingdomship, as it were, he disappears and nobody can find him. So the third act is all about the fact that they've been dragging the river and every pond and looking under every stone because they think there's a body somewhere.
So they find him in the well or something.
Or they think they have.
Right. This is going to be an exciting performance. So we're glad you stopped in today to chat with us about it.
Thank you very much.
Joining me in Studio B is Zach Phillips. Welcome.
Thank you, Dean McCoy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Zach is a triple major senior, right?
Yeah, I'm doing the big trifecta, music, Spanish, and philosophy.
And philosophy. So what are you doing with your spare time?
My spare time.
Yeah, you're playing in the opera.
Which I do not have. Right. Yeah, I'm playing in the opera. I'm practicing furiously in the practice rooms.
All right. So you're in the pit for the opera, correct?
Yes.
Now, a lot of folks have no concept of how an opera is put together. We have people on stage. We have people in the pit. Have you been rehearsing all along with the musicians on the stage?
No, we have yet to actually put it together with the singers. But we did. We got the music in early December, and we were supposed to, you know, go at our parts, but because it's actually not quite like a regular opera would be with a pit orchestra. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the beautiful parts about it, I think, is it's just got a string quartet and then your regular woodwinds.
Right.
So it's a lot more, I'd like to say, personal, the instrumentation.
It's much more chamber-like.
Yes, yeah, very much chamber-like. And it's nice because it has an exposure to the instruments, which sometimes can be good if you practice, and a lot of times it can be bad. So it's kind of like it tells you, you need to learn this part a little bit better, and helps out with musicianship. So.
Right. When we put together an opera, the stage actors do their thing, and the pit musicians do their thing.
Yeah.
And after they've done some individual work as a pit musician, then they get together with the rest of the pit, and they rehearse still without the actors.
Yeah.
And then how many rehearsals do you get with the actors actually ready to put on the show?
12.
Yeah. So this is interesting because you've already got your act together, and you've already done your own thing, and now suddenly, drop you in there and put this thing together in a hurry.
And we are ready to go. We're always ready to go because it seems like Professor Smith keeps his eye on, and he's the conductor. He's great, fabulous. And it seems like he always keeps his eye on the orchestra, the pit orchestra, and the eye on the singers, and sees the two and then lines them up and then brings them together, almost like a puzzle piece, and it just goes bop every year.
So it's how's playing in the opera different than playing in the orchestra?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, aside from the distraction of always wanting to look to your left, you know.
And see what the singers are up to.
Yeah, see what's going on, you know. Ooh, wow, that's a beautiful costume. Ooh, that's, you know, that's great.
And this is a very unusual pit, too, because it's like chamber music in the pit.
Yeah, and that's a fun part. We actually just had a string quartet, or quintet, rather, rehearsal last Friday with Professor Smith, and just went over a few of the spots. And it's fun because there is chamber music there. There's that element that you are the violin, you're playing with the second violin, and then there's a viola, and that's just the only viola, and you get to look at him and play and say, yes, this is what I'm doing. Oh, we have it together. And chamber music at its finest. So
great. Well, we're glad you came in to join us today.
Well, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
Last week we started with the 5-minute iPod. You're stuck on a desert island, your iPod only has 5 minutes. What would it be? Joining us this week is Misty Shaw, our librarian. Welcome.
Hello.
We're happy to have you here, and your iPod's got 5 minutes on it, so what is it?
It is going to be the second movement of Shostakovich String Quartet 8, the Allegro Molto, and it's quite violent.
So why this piece?
Why not this piece? It's so emotional, it's hectic, it's frenetic, it's frantic. Shostakovich wrote this piece to sound as though the bombing of Dresden is happening, the devastating bombing that happened in World War II.
Right.
And you really do feel like there might be bombs dropping around you when you listen to this.
So can just anybody play this piece for your 5-minute iPod?
I recommend the Emerson String Quartet. They've made a whole set of these recordings, CD 3261, in the music library. I can't recommend it enough.
So you spend enough time playing Shostakovich, you really bring him to life in a new way.
Absolutely.
You got it. Very powerful piece. Thank you for bringing it to us.
It was my pleasure.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Joining me in Studio B of the Green Center to discuss our opera, Albert Herring, we have Albert Herring. This is Lucas Wassmer. He's a junior voice major playing Albert. We also have Joey Lepic, who is a freshman voice major who plays the mayor. Welcome, guys.
Good to be here.
Is this your first time in an opera?
No, I was actually involved in the opera my freshman year. I was in The Marriage of Figaro. I played Antonio, the drunken gardener. And then in my sophomore year, I was the math book in The Child and the Magic, L'Enfant.
Ah, great. And what about you, Joey?
This is my first time ever being in an opera.
All right. So how's that experience for you, as being the first time? Is it intimidating?
Yeah, it was intimidating at first, but once I got into the groove of it, it was really enjoyable for me.
So you having a good time?
Oh, yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is.
Especially being the lead, being the title character
I mean,
and all.
That's a lot of fun, yeah.
I had to book through your agent to get you in here today.
Definitely.
Yeah, I see how that works. So we have a new opera director this year, too.
Yeah, Professor Schomburger is just absolutely great. I really love working with him. He has a lot of great ideas. You know, he's very... he's really personable. It's his projections. He's showed us some of the pictures, and the projections will come in and out of the big white wall.
Right, that's what's different here. We don't really have much of a set because we're doing projections for the set work. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's gonna be really cool. A good example is, like, there's a part in the second act when you know, everyone's hailing Britain rules, and it's the Britain flag fades in the wall. It just covers the entire set, basically. So you have this huge British flag in the background while everybody's, you know, hailing Britain.
Fantastic. So this opera is relatively unusual opera.
Yeah, it's a chamber opera, technically. You know, thing like this opera has never been done at the Met. So yeah, it's kind of, it's a little different.
And it's Benjamin Britten, so it's a relatively new opera by opera standards, I suppose.
Yeah.
So are you in the chorus as well as playing the part of the mayor, or are you just the mayor?
Well, there really isn't a chorus in this opera. There's not really a set chorus, but I'm kind of part of a larger ensemble of people. But I also get a lot of my own solo singing and stuff. And each, there's like a chorus, but each of them kind of have their own songs that they get to sing.
Have you begun rehearsing with the orchestra yet?
We had our first Sitzprobe yesterday, actually.
How'd that go?
It went pretty well. The orchestra is still, we started rehearsing a lot sooner, but than they did. So they're still kind of getting the feel of it. And Britain is, the music's very difficult. But we went all the way through Act 1 and did a little bit of Act 3, and it went very well. So
if you've never seen an opera before, and you're coming to see this one, what will we really love about this opera?
Well, first of all, you'll love that it was originally written in English. So there's no weird translation like in the last two operas we had. You know, sometimes the English didn't make a whole lot of sense. But here, it's specifically written for English. So as long, hopefully, you can understand what we're saying.
Right.
And you'll be able to follow the story really well. And the projections are definitely a very unique experience. Even if you've never come to an opera before, you know, this will seem, I think it would seem very exciting and new, you know, and then if you go to another one afterwards, you know, you can see the differences, so.
Right.
There's a lot of comedic aspects of the opera, too, that I think some people will enjoy.
Yeah, it's funny, I played Antonio my freshman year and I was drunk, and in the second scene,
is this typecasting
in the second scene of Albert Herring, I'm drunk, basically, through the last, you know, three quarters of it. So.
Right, not intentionally, correct?
Not intentionally, no. Sid slips some rum into my lemonade.
Yes.
In Act 2. And
then our poor innocent ends up as a drunk.
Yeah.
Yes. Tell me, what's a great moment in this opera that we... What's your favorite musical moment?
My favorite musical moment? I don't know if I really have a favorite... But my favorite moment is when Albert comes back in Act 3... you know, throughout the entire opera, Albert is very shy. He's very inward. But at the end, he walks in. Everyone thinks he's dead. He walks in. He goes, "What's going on?" And everyone freaks out. And he's just out from under his mom's thumb. He's really, you know, he's
finally found his own.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is a great story for college age folks. It's a great coming into your own type story. Well, we appreciate you guys coming in today.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Too crude for mother. There you are.
Don't mind farthings, do you? Thanks, mister.
Joining me in the studio is Clara Jagula and J.C. Pankratz. Welcome.
Hi.
Thanks.
We're here to chat about an innovative project you two were involved in. Tell us about it.
We started the Reformation Arts Project at Putnamville Correctional Facility. And what it is, we're bringing DePauw student performances to Putnamville to perform for the prisoners.
Putnamville is?
It's a correctional facility, so it houses, I think, nearly 2,000.
Yeah, it's a medium security prison.
So how'd this come about?
Actually, last spring I went to the auditions for the new dean, and at yours, I had asked a question, and you asked a question in your response, and it was, what are you doing to reach out to the people who aren't in the School of Music? And I had this thought, I was like, wow, I'm not doing anything. And so I started thinking, and I was like, well, okay, who can I reach out to that can't possibly come in? And then the idea came up with was the prisoners, because there is no way that they are coming to the School of Music. So I was like, well, we have to bring the music to them. So
that's fantastic. And this is interesting, because we should note that JC is actually not a music major. She's a playwright and a creative writing major, correct?
Yeah, I am.
So this is a great pairing. So how'd you two get together on this?
JC's one of those people like that gets things done.
It's true.
And she has lots of connections in the theater department. So when I was thinking of people who might be interested, I asked JC, who was aboard, like, in a second.
I am. I have some experience working on community arts projects before. And it's something that I've always been really interested in because, I mean, my community arts experience is more like going into neighborhoods like in Indianapolis and helping with, you know, arts projects in that community. But I've actually always wanted to go work in prisons. I have a couple supervisors who've done it before and they find it a really rewarding experience. And
so what did you guys do? What did you take to the prison?
Last time we took, I think there were six girls who expressed interest and said, yes, I want to go. Two of us sang. I performed a 20th century piece.
Which they loved.
They really love 20th century music.
Now, this is interesting. These are prisoners who probably never heard classical music in their life anyway. Yeah. So how are they handling this?
They knew what was good. Like Jennifer Wilson sang two classical pieces. One was an aria. The other was an art song. At the end, where she sang this really high note, they were all mid-performance. They were all clapping.
Wow.
It was an outstanding response.
No, it was. I've never seen an audience engaged in that my whole life. And like, I'm a theater person, so I see a lot of audiences, as I'm sure you guys do.
Wow.
And they were more enwrapped and engaged during every moment of the performance than probably any student or non-student audience I've ever seen.
Was there a space to perform?
They had a chapel. It was really cold.
And could it fit very many prisoners at once?
A few hundred. I mean, I think like 100 came.
Yeah, there was even a part I remember because I was sitting there like on deck or whatever, and they were like, there were a couple guys and they were like kind of slumped down with their heads closed, like with their head on their hand. And I was like, oh man, are they asleep? No, they were just really into it. Do you remember that? And they're like, they were really absorbing it.
Yeah, one of them, he was down the whole performance. Yeah. And Rachel Lowry was singing an Italian art song. He was down the whole performance. At the end, he stood up and gave her a standing ovation.
Wow. So you've done this once?
We did this once, yeah. It was actually pretty hard to, like, coordinate with the prison because
you walk, hi, we're DePauw students, we'd like to sing for your prisoners, and
I went down there personally because it was really hard to get a hold of someone on the phone because they're really short staffed,
So it's really hard to bring in volunteer projects, but just because there isn't enough time and energy to do things other than the norm.
Well, you know, you bring up you actually are proof of a point that I make, and that is that if we have this artistic gift in theater or art or music, we don't have just the opportunity to share it. We have the obligation to share it, you know. And you were probably the highlight of these folks' year, decade, whatever. You don't know. But here we're taking classical music to people who've never heard it before and having people be that moved by it. And that's fantastic. That's what this is about. And part of what we do with Music for Life is we talk to the community, the School of Music, the College of Liberal Arts, the wider Greencast community, and invite them in to the School of Music to hear our concerts. But we're also out a lot performing, and we're glad you guys chose to do this. I'm very impressed with your initiative, and I hope you'll do it again.
Yeah, we're going this Friday.
And what's happening this Friday?
I'm actually not sure.
There's guitar and ukulele duet, two violinists, and a soft shoe tap routine.
Wow.
Yeah.
So do you have more scheduled beyond this one?
They aren't scheduled yet, but we're planning on going a few more times this semester.
Way to go.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Tell me. Flattery.
Joining us for the question you never asked is Adam Lumen. Welcome.
Thanks for letting me be here.
What's our question this week?
What do all those numbers and letters and abbreviations mean at the end of a piece?
Often the first one is always OP, because you'll see something that says Beethoven's First Symphony, Opus 21.
That's the opus number. So, you know, back in the day when these were written, when things were published, usually the publisher would give it an opus number, and then later the composers would actually give their pieces opus numbers. So the first thing you have OP period, that's the opus.
What's opus mean?
It means work.
Work.
To compare it to something from today, I would say it's kind of like the album title.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you'll have numbers. So like opus 4, number 1 is...
the fourth work, the first piece.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, kind of like the way Chicago named all their albums early on in the day. Mm-hmm. Yes, okay. So opus is simply the work number. It's putting all their works in order and we number them. So opus 1 is your first work.
Usually. Sometimes there will be pieces that they wrote earlier, but it didn't get published. So it's not exactly in chronological order. But often it'll be generally in the order of when they were published.
And if it gets so messed up and somebody comes in to work on it, then what happens?
Then you end up with these new systems of numbers. For example, in Mozart, you have the Kerschel numbers, where this person listed all of Mozart's works from 1 to about 622.
Mm-hmm. And so now, in the case of Mozart, we don't get an opus number, we get a K number, because he numbered them all for us, and so now we refer to them by his cataloging system, so he gets a K number. Who else gets weird numbers?
Two other ones that commonly do are Bach and Haydn.
Yeah, what's Haydn's number, or letters?
You'll see H-O-B.
H-O-B, what's that mean?
Hoboken numbers,
mm-hmm. And
which
that?
Is, again, the name of the person who came up with the system.
Oh, so here's a way to make yourself famous with another great composer. Just number their works and make sure it's right, and then you can have your initials stuck next to their name,
yep,
right?
It'll be on every concert for the next 100 years.
So Haydn, like Mozart, does not have an OP number. Doesn't have his works are not listed as opus numbers. Oh. They're listed as H-O-B.
Some of them. For some of the string quartets, you'll still see the opus numbers listed.
Oh.
So it kind of goes back and forth between both systems.
Ah, that just to make sure we're on our toes.
Mm-hmm.
And then what about Bach?
Bach, you'll see BWV, which stands for the German Bach Work Catalog.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting with the BWV numbers. For example, just today we heard Ian Davison play the Sonata in G Minor, the Bach work, which was BWV 1030B. So that tells us a good bit about that work.
And those, instead of being listed in the order they were written, they're going to be listed by the type of work, which works well until you discover a new work by Bach that and your numbers 1 through 1,000 are filled up. So then you have to put that one at the end,
mm-hmm.
and it gets a little bit more confusing.
Yeah, so there again, that's not necessarily chronological. Why are these things valuable to us? As musicians, why even an opus number? What difference does it make?
Just knowing when it was written in the person's life, if it's grouped with other pieces, knowing the relationship between those is important to really understand the music.
Right. In a way, you can never step in the same river twice. And no composer is ever the same person as they're writing two pieces. So if you see something with a low opus number, then you know that that was early on in that composer's career, and the larger opus numbers, that was later in their career. And those might be completely different composers from their first to their last piece.
Yeah.
And they're often categorized in groups, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
Beethoven has three periods. And
even when there's less distinct periods as Beethoven, like with Mozart, you know, you'll have the earlier ones. And then, you know, later around 426, he gets influenced by Bach's music,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see that start to happen. It's a great way to see where in their compositional life this piece is.
And it's amazing how much information that you can get just off a sheet of paper. And the more that you get to know these composers, especially as individuals, the more those opus numbers or BWV numbers or Kerschel numbers or whatever, the more those numbers mean to us. Thanks for sharing that with us.
Thanks for having me.
This week we're focusing on our opera, Albert Herring. And joining me in the studio for the first time is our new director, Joachim Schomburger. Welcome.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very good.
We are thrilled to have you here because as a visiting professor, you bring an experience that oftentimes we would not otherwise have because you're all over the world. You were just last week.
Last week, I just came from New York doing a production there. Last year was a crazy year. I was all over the place working on a project in China, was in Israel in the summer, in Germany, a lot of states within America. So, yeah, lots of traveling.
This is your first production with us at DePauw, and people are singing your praises.
Glad to hear that.
You seem to be having quite a good time and quite an impact on our students. And they're also talking about the fact that you're more than doing the direction, you're also involved in the presentation.
Yes, in the whole set design and in something I call virtual theater design. It's a whole concept that's based on projections and that brings a lot of movie storytelling devices onto the opera stage.
And you've done this in a lot of different places.
Yes, yes, a lot, in about now 15 productions.
So tell us about how that applies to this one.
Well, the projections that you will see are really more than suggesting the location. They help tell the story in a lot of beautiful ways. The story here is in England around the turn of the last century, and we kept it there. You know, often operas will be updated, but we have a set that gives a somewhat a timeless feeling to it and will touch on deeper levels of that opera.
You have worked with professionals and with large graduate programs. Is this your first time in an undergraduate-only institution?
In an undergrad-only, yes. I've worked intensively with students of all levels.
Right.
In different summer programs, training programs for singers. But it's the first time with like an only undergrad cast, and I'm thrilled about the level. I was really like, first, it's a very challenging opera. Mm-hmm. It's really is difficult musically and vocally, and it's a comedy where you really just can't just stand and sing. It's right. A lot about acting. So a lot of things come together here, and I was really, really more than pleasantly surprised about the level and how well the students do.
And you guys have been hard at it. I mean, you, because of your schedule, you're flying all over the world, you're in multiple productions at the same time, and then you're here for a few weeks and just never taking a break and flying away and then coming back for a few weeks and back at it again. How do you keep up the pace?
I don't know. You do one thing at a time. And you just have to learn to be where you are at this point. And I guess otherwise plan ahead and be organized.
So I know it's often the case with professional opera directors such as yourself that you will get a piece up and running and then jet to the next event. Will you get a chance to see this production?
Yes, of course.
You will?
Yeah, of course. No, for this. From the beginning on, we made clear I would be here for all four performances.
That is wonderful.
Yes,
oh,
sure.
Great news. Because in the professional world, it's not at all uncommon to get it up and running and disappear before it even premieres.
True. Actually, I'm going to do a production of Aida with Opera Tampa after this, and I won't be able to see even the performing night, right, let alone the other performances, just because I already have to go on to the next.
It's one of the remarkable things about DePauw that we can bring a director of your caliber to town and to have you work with our students and to so infuse them with energy and excitement about their trade and their art, and then to have you really raise our game because you've brought your professional expectations to an undergraduate institution. We're thrilled that we have you here.
Thank you. And I have to say, in terms of professionalism, also with the whole stage, when I designed the set for this and the stage crew, everybody there, Dwayne Skook was amazing. And Caroline Good has done a beautiful job with her students, and they have designed costumes specifically for this opera. It's going to be a really, really nice show.
So how did you come to opera?
I grew up with opera. I grew up in Germany in a little town in northern Bavaria. And my parents loved the opera. They took me to the opera ever since I was like 5 years old. And I loved it. I went to see many operas. And later on, when I went to a music conservatory, first actually studying and being trained in voice, vocal performance, I had seen about 100 different operas live on stage.
Wow.
And wasn't even realizing that that's something special. Because it was just so second nature to me. So that brought me to opera, and later on, the directing really was just a simple step because that's what I had done my whole life. I went to the opera and in my mind had pictured how I would want to see it anyway.
From the conservatory, you just launched into directing?
No, I performed for 5 years as a professional singer in Germany. And during that time, I was thinking about directing and trying to do it both at a time. And when I talked to experienced directors, what their path was, they all said, no, sing first, and when you're older, you can switch over to directing. And I felt, but I want to do it now. So and then it's a long story that actually that brought me to America. I met some people in Italy in a program from Brooklyn Conservatory. And long story short, I quit my job as a singer and came to the States and made my way into directing.
And how long have you been directing? How many years have you been directing now?
About 6-7 years.
Wow. And though Professor Schomburger his works will be seen around the world, you can see them in Greencastle just next weekend, right around the corner. Four great performances of Albert Herring, and it's been our pleasure to have you on campus this year, and we look forward to your production.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We are honored to have joining us in Studio B in the Green Center, Mr. Vernon Jordan. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking of a way to introduce you, and I thought we could say a towering figure in American politics, a towering figure in the civil rights, maybe it's just a towering figure. Welcome to a towering figure. We're so happy to have you here.
Well,
today.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Now, what's brought you here today is actually two purposes. Of course, as one of our distinguished alumni, we look forward to your talk tonight in Meharry Hall. But also, by a bit of synchronicity, as part of our Music of the 21st Century, we were able to bring back the original narrator for a work that we're doing with Joseph Schwantner, New Morning for the World, and have you narrate with the band for our closing concert. So this has come full circle for you. You did the very first performance of this work, and now you're doing the very latest.
Well, it was very exciting to stand there with the DePauw band behind me and with the DePauw professor conducting, and it brought back very warm and exciting memories of Greencastle. I was a political science major and a history minor and a speech minor. But I also belong to Doozadoo. So today on the stage, I felt like I was back here acting as I did at the theater for 3 days in a play that my schoolmates and classmates wrote, and I had the leading role in it. So being on the stage today with the band and reading Schwantner's work just brought me back to my days here when I did things other than study and prepare for exams.
That's part of the excitement of the liberal arts tradition, is that you get to partake in so many things. And to have someone as a political science major on stage acting is a part of what we do so well at DePauw.
Also, it's thrilling to be reading the words of Martin Luther King Jr., mm-hmm. who was my neighbor, my friend, my coworker, and who was for me in my young years a huge inspiration. I heard him give the Emancipation Proclamation speech in Atlanta in 1956.
Wow.
And that was a reaffirmation moment for me that I would work in civil rights.
And in a way, it's come full circle, because he was such an inspiration to you, and you've been such an inspiration to the next generation. So it's wonderful to see that handed on.
Well, that's generous.
It has been such a privilege for the band to have the opportunity to perform. And when they found out that Vernon Jordan was going to come back and narrate them, two things happened. One, I think there was a wave of excitement, and followed immediately by a wave of panic that they were going to have to be better than they had ever been so that they could...
Well, I thought they were better than me this morning.
Well, we are thrilled. DePauw has so many wonderful alum, and known more so than Vernon Jordan, and it has been our honor to have you back on campus.
Thank you so much.
We hope you'll come home again soon.
Thank you.
Stopping by the studio now is Ian Davidson, a graduate of DePauw from 1980. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's very great to be here today.
Ian's a professional oboe player and also a professor in Texas, and he's on one of his many jaunts performing tours. So you were just somewhere just before you got to us.
I was in Miami after this, and a couple stops, and then back to Texas.
Give us a synopsis. I mean, you do so many things. You're performing in orchestra.
I'm the associate principal oboe of the Austin Symphony and assistant principal in English horn of the Austin Lyric Opera Orchestra, and in addition to being a full professor at Texas State University. And so all three of those things keep me very busy. The symphony and the opera, about 200 services a year. But in addition to that, I play in a quintet, and I do some contracting, and I do freelance recording. And
I've done some studio work.
Studio work, some films.
Been
some
on PBS
CDs,
and some
PBS,
great films. I mean, all kinds of incredible things happening. And it's always great when we have our own comeback. And this has been particularly exciting for us because Ian is like a favorite son here. He's done, you know, he's one of our all-stars. He's done so many great things.
Very kind of you.
And the students were just lit up by the conversation today.
I'm glad.
You know, didn't you feel the energy?
I did. The conversation. Very exciting. Very exciting.
Yeah, and they were so thrilled to have you here because they were able to see that this is what happens to DePauw students. You know, you gave a great conversation about your experiences at DePauw and how that turned into this incredibly successful life that you, that, you know, very fulfilling life.
I'm very thankful for my time here at DePauw.
Tell us about it. How did DePauw prepare such a great musician?
You know, I think more than anything else, it's the environment of DePauw, the combination of being around the liberal arts students as well as the music students. So I spent a lot of time with students who were econ majors and philosophy majors and English majors. These people were as much my friends as the music students. So I was in the liberal arts environment. In fact, every time we would have lunch or we would have dinner, we would sit down and we would have discussions about the topics of the day, not who's got the best recording of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, et cetera. And I think you don't get that at a big university and you don't get it at a conservatory.
Right.
This is one of a handful of places, if there are even a handful of places in the country, where you have this marriage of first-class music education combined with the liberal arts environment.
The world's full of great players that understand the technique of playing. But then there's also these people who really speak through their music. They have something to say. They don't just know how to say it. They have something very profound to say. And those people are people who are very wise people in the ways of the world. They're very informed. They're not musical savants. They're people who've been trained in this liberal arts setting, and they have this understanding of the bigger picture of music, and they play their music in a context. And as I heard you playing the Bach today, I thought, you know, this is not just beautiful playing. This is meaningful playing.
You refer to the Bach, and you refer to the expression in the Bach. I'm reminded of a class I took in English literature when I was a senior. And Professor Updahl, great teacher, he said something about every writer, they have to write what they know. And I took that phrase and made it into a musical phrase. You have to play what you know. So that when I'm playing, it's, you know, Bach wrote the music, but I have to bring my voice to it, and I can only bring to it what I actually know. And part of the reason why I travel as much as I do is the greater my life experience gets, the more I bring to bear when I'm going to play Bach.
The bigger your life, the bigger your music.
Well, and I think this is also where the liberal arts situation comes into play. You know, you can go to any of a number of fine institutions, and they're going to teach you the basics of music theory, of ear training, music history. You'll get to play in an ensemble. But if you don't have, in addition to that, all the problem-solving skills, all of the things that come from the liberal arts education, and very much so the liberal arts environment, then you're behind everybody.
You're music in a context.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, we've been thrilled to have you on campus, even for a short time, and I hope that all of our listeners will look you up and Google you and find out all the great things that you're doing. And, you know, you are exactly the type of musician and leader that we always hope to produce at DePauw, and we're so thrilled that we were a part of your background and glad that we can count you as one of our favorite sons.
Well, thank you. I am thrilled to be a DePauw Tiger, class of 1980.
Well, thank you for coming back.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a real thrill for me.
And now we'll hear some of this remarkable performance of the Bach. And this is Claude Zimmerman, our own faculty member that we've heard from in shows past, accompanying on piano.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up our show this week, and we're glad you could join us at Music for Life, Music from DePauw. Our student producers are Sam Crocker, Adam Luman, Anna Gadula, and Phil Pasqua. Our show is produced and engineered by Matthew Champagne and recorded live in Studio B of the Green Center for the Performing Arts. I'm Mark McCoy. I'm the executive producer of Music for Life and dean of the School of Music. And we're glad you could join us once again. And we hope that you'll join us next Sunday night at 6 p.m. on WGRE for Music for Life. You can also catch us on the podcast, available at iTunes. And you can email us at musicforlife@depauw.edu. We're going to wrap up our show with the exciting performance of the finale of Joseph Schwantner's second percussion concerto that was performed in Kresge Hall just last week. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you this week in the Green Center for the Performing Arts.